Welcome to a special episode of Conduct Detrimental. As promised, our guest this week, alongside Dan Wallach, is Don Van Natta. Don, big week
Junior,
for you.
Great to see you guys again. How are you both doing?
Doing great. You know, it's when an episode lures me out of semi-retirement, you know, it's a special episode. It's been last couple of months. I've become a first-time father, so I've kind of laid low and only come out for the big guns like you and probably just you.
I don't know. You were about to say another one. That was
months.
It.
Congrats, Dan. I didn't know that. That's wonderful news. Good for you.
Yeah.
How's your sleep doing?
Ask my wife. She has the primary responsibilities, but I do my part, and he's shaping up to be a nice, you know, he's going to be a big boy, I think. And we already have collectives, you know, making visits, and we are scheduling a visit from Nick Saban. So
I thought you said collectives. I didn't know if there was something being lost in translation. You meant collectives.
Yeah. Yep.
That's for our NIL podcast. All good. So let's jump right into it. As we discussed in the last episode, unless you're living under a rock, the stories about the Washington Commanders have kind of been nonstop between July of 2020 and the present. Obviously, Dan Snyder's ownership of the team is now reaching its end. But for 20 plus years, he had these are our words. We'll just say there was a controversial era of ownership. And as we head into the final phases, I think as we're recording this at 2 o'clock on Wednesday or Thursday, July 20th, there is a vote occurring over with NFL owners. We'll see. Maybe by the time this podcast is public, Dan Snyder will officially no longer be the owner. But that said, Don, your reporting alongside Seth Wickersham have been really instrumental. You've dropped a number of stories. And I think I think your reporting and staying diligent on this has expedited the time frame. So, of course, story that's been so close to our show over the last 3 years, we wanted to have you on to kind of tell the final chapter in the saga. But excellent reporting. And maybe we'll start there, Don. So you dropped the story this past week. And the story, at least my reading of it, there were 3 points that I don't think many people knew about. We can certainly get into the history here and some kind of overarching Dan Snyder themes. Where I wanted to start is maybe a misconception I'm seeing across social media. People read your story and maybe they just skimmed it, or they just told people they read it, or at least they got the clicks, Don. That's what you guys need. But people said, oh, this story basically confirms that Dan Snyder was the leak. And I said, that's the exact opposite of the story. It certainly does not say that. In fact, it says the opposite. So two names that came up in your story that are not generally associated with the John Gruden email leaks. Number one, DeMarie Smith, executive director over at the NFLPA. And the other name that was new to me with respect to the story is someone by the name of Desiree Perez, CEO of Roc Nation. So I want to start with DeMarie Smith. I found your reporting on his inclusion to be very interesting. I kind of buy that theory, but Don, where is your head going now in terms of DeMarie Smith? Do you find him to be the leader in the clubhouse? I mean, how do you view him?
Well, I don't see him as the leader in the clubhouse, but certainly our reporting that I did with Seth Wickersham on the piece pointed to him having a role in the initial leak. So there were two leaks, as you guys know. There was a first leak to the Wall Street Journal of a single email that John Gruden had written 10 years earlier. That email subject was actually DeMarie Smith, who was only 2 years on the job as executive director of the National Football League Players Association. And Gruden used a racist trope to describe Smith. It was a nasty email. It was leaked to the Wall Street Journal. And the timing is really critical here. It was leaked to the journal on a Friday in October 2021, the same day that DeMarie Smith was facing a vote for a contract extension by 32 player reps. D's job was literally on the line when this email that Gruden wrote to Bruce Allen, the president of the Washington football team 10 years earlier. And what we had, our reporting showed that D. Smith told a very close associate that he was involved in the leaking of that email to the Wall Street Journal. That had never been reported before. Now, I want to be very clear with your listeners, guys, that D. Declined multiple attempts by me to speak with me on the record for this story. George Atala, the spokesman for the union, also declined to comment. But I don't necessarily see him as leader of the clubhouse. I see him as somebody, and this is what our sources told us, is somebody that had a motive to get that email out and the timing. And I should be clear that that vote that happened later that day after the Wall Street Journal had that leak, D kept his job. He got a contract extension by the vote of the 32 player reps by a single vote. And the idea is that that email leak would possibly engender sympathy among the player reps. That's what our sources told us. And that would be the motive that D Smith would have had if he, in fact, did was involved in the leaking of that email to the Wall Street Journal reporter, Andrew Beaton.
See, it's funny. I mean, the email leaks to some extent are something that did result in someone losing their jobs. The part that I took away from your DeMaurice section in there, and you know, we could talk kind of at a higher level too, but the fact that he was, I think the word that was used in your report was that he was bragging to some that he was the leak. So I found that interesting. And Don, I'll say this, and I said it on a previous podcast when we were talking about you. Your track record, despite some, we'll say some statements issued by Dan Snyder and other people associated with the story, your track record's been pretty spot on. And also Baxter Holmes with respect to the Phoenix Suns reporting, also spot on despite some denials. But I read that, obviously, in the DeMaurice Smith report. And then, you know, the other chapter, which we can briefly get into, and then we can kind of unpack Snyder, who I, you know, I guess it is what it is. I've never believed the Snyder theory of events. I've never believed that Snyder had a true motivation as a, hey, look at these John Gruden emails as a smokescreen to not pay attention to my house on fire. I mean, I don't really think that that does anything, but I do buy the DeMaurice Smith theory. The other theory that I buy is number two, this Desiree Perez and NFL kind of social justice. So I don't believe it was in your article, but I heard you on ESPN Daily, you know, with Jeremy Schapp talking about this $25 million contract between Roc Nation and the NFL with respect to social justice issues. So I had never heard of that. I did my digging, and then apparently this is a deal that seemingly was agreed to a number of years ago. I haven't heard of this, any explicit wins that are directed towards Roc Nation. But, right, if you're delivered $25 million to help with social justice issues, eventually you have to have a big win. And in terms of thinking of theories, this is another one that plausibly makes sense. Hey, we gave you guys $25 million. What have you done for us? Here's an easy win. It's sitting here for the taking. I buy theory number two with respect to Desiree Perez.
Well, Roc Nation was brought on by Roger Goodell and the NFL, actually at the suggestion of Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, after the Colin Kaepernick controversy. And it was a way for the NFL to turn the page on that kneeling controversy. If you remember, it helped erode the TV ratings for the NFL when President Donald Trump took on the NFL in such a aggressive manner. And so the hiring of Roc Nation and CEO Desiree Perez by the NFL, and it was in 2019, was done in large part for the firm to help the NFL get past the Colin Kaepernick chapter and work on social justice messaging. Now, I should also say another part of their portfolio was to help put on the Super Bowl halftime shows. And they've gotten very, very high marks by everybody for that. So that's another piece of the portfolio of what they're supposed to do. But Desiree Perez's role in this, as described to us by sources, legal sources, as well as people that are inside the league office, is they accused her of having some kind of role. That's what we reflected in the story. And let me give you a little bit of backstory on Desiree Perez. So Ms. Perez is a member of Dan Snyder's board of directors for the Commanders. So she is somebody who is close to both Dan and Tanya Snyder. At the same time, she is a consultant for the NFL on social justice issues, as I said. And she also was somebody who had Roger Goodell's ear. So she's straddling both these worlds. Now, we can talk about the Snyder motivation for why our reporting and our sources told us that actually this got triggered by Snyder and why he wanted to give Goodell a chance to do this. But as we reflected in the story, our sources told us that Desiree Perez did play a role. I want to be very clear. She would not speak with me for the story. I gave her multiple opportunities to do so over a course of several weeks. Her attorney spoke to ESPN's attorney and denied that she had anything to do with the leaks or even knew that the leaks existed. But if you read our story carefully, we have multiple sources pointing a finger at Desiree Perez that she was involved. And It's hard to imagine that she wouldn't have a role if you consider the fact that she's not only a Dan and Tanya Snyder confidant and somebody who gives advice to them, but also somebody who has Roger Goodell's ear. And so what the sources that we talk to, oh, and I should add one other, there's one other connection. So Reed Smith, the New York law firm, which I'm sure we'll also talk about.
It's an important connection.
It's an important connection. Reed Smith is Dan Snyder's attorney, a law firm. They're also Roc Nation's law firm. And we know from other sources that the representation of Alex Rodriguez and his lawsuit against Major League Baseball was handled by Reed Smith, as well as a New York attorney named Joe Tacopina, who's also one of Donald Trump's personal defense attorneys.
People have heard of Joe Tacopina.
Yeah. Do you guys know Joe?
I don't know him, but listeners will be familiar with Joe Tacopina.
Okay. No, man, I'm from New York, right? I grew up in practice law in New York. He's not famed attorney Joe Tacopina. He's media savvy Joe Tacopina, very good lawyer, but one whose reputation as portrayed in the media is probably a little bit disproportionate to the actual results. You know, he believe me, everybody practices law. Even if you read the tabloids in New York, Joe Tacopina is a name that people know, but it doesn't necessarily mean he's, the best, one of the great defense lawyers in New York. He's aggressive. He's very aggressive. And that's where I wanted to transition the next discussion to, which is a callback to your earlier piece last year about Dan Snyder having dirt on all the various owners, and that would have had a chilling effect on the ownership fraternity's willingness to banish him from the league. And you provide more color on that aspect of the story in the new piece. And I'll just throw two words out at you: blackmail PowerPoint. That is
blackmail
a name.
PowerPoint.
I think that great could name. Be a great Netflix series. But you provide some details that sort of build on your earlier reporting and how that could have, sort of greased the skids for Snyder having an undue amount of influence and control over the Wilkinson investigation. So my question to you is, how bad was this presentation? You allude to damaging emails, none of which were offensive or contained, profane information, but left unsaid was what these emails actually contained. Were they directed at certain owners or certain individuals within NFL management?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So it really is a continuation of the story we did last October, where we had an associate quoting Dan Snyder, where he said the NFL is a mafia, and that if he's ever forced to sell his team, he is going to, basically burn the league down with the information that he's developed through a network of private investigators. He told that to owners. He said he had gathered dirt on a number of owners, including Cowboys owner Jerry Jones, as well as Commissioner Roger Goodell. What happened in June of, so this is the following year, in June of 2021. So it's basically after Beth Wilkinson does her exhaustive investigation, Snyder is summoned basically with his lawyers to the NFL league office to make a defense on the Wilkinson investigation. And rather than make a defense on any of the allegations or any of the findings that Beth Wilkinson has come up with, Joe Tacopina, who was the lead lawyer with two lawyers from Reed Smith, Jordan Siv and Jim McCarroll, had a PowerPoint of slides of emails. And the emails are, as you said, off color, kind of embarrassing language, basically by NFL executives. I don't know that any owners were quoted in it. That's not what our reporting shows. Our reporting shows that it was primarily about NFL executives. These emails were gleaned during the Beth Wilkinson investigation. Wilkinson collected about 650,000 emails. And inside the league office, they were stunned that this was the strategy. Now, the strategy from the point of view of Tacopina and the Reed Smith lawyers is, hey, how dare you try to judge Dan Snyder for anything that he's done with an alleged toxic workplace culture when you've got similar problems inside the league office? So it was sort of a, you guys are hypocrites kind of argument that was advanced by Tacopina. But the lawyers and the top executives of the NFL were stunned by this. They dubbed this PowerPoint the blackmail PowerPoint. Some of the emails were actually written by Jeff Pasch, the general counsel of the NFL. Some of those emails later on, by the way, were part of the leaks that went to the New York Times. And it was important for us to show it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it shows how the lawyers for Snyder weaponized these emails in his own defense. That was very, very important to show because, again, just a few months later, we have sources telling us that Snyder and his law firm actually greenlit a way to get these Gruden emails out. And we can talk about what the motive of that was. But here's the second part of it that didn't get a lot of attention. The people inside the league office were so offended by this tactic by Tacopina and the Reed Smith lawyers, they wanted Goodell to hammer Dan Snyder with a very severe punishment. That was the recommendation that was made to the commissioner. But instead, Roger Goodell went the other way and basically allowed Dan Snyder to dictate the terms of his own punishment. We had multiple sources tell us. The fine that was given to Snyder is nothing more than a slap on the wrist. It was a $10 million team fine. He didn't even have to pay it out of his own pocket. And he was given this sort of hazy language in the press release that came out from the NFL about the punishment that he had to step away from the team for some undisclosed amount of time. There was some debate between Snyder's lawyers and the league later of whether it was a suspension or not, or how formal it was going to be. And that was it. And we have this one fact that, again, didn't get a lot of attention to your point, Dan, early on. And that is that Snyder was even in the loop in the writing of the press release that the NFL put out. He was in the loop of exactly what language was going to be in that press release. And if you go back and look at that press release, there's far more language about Snyder writing the ship. Dan and Tanya Snyder are now turning around this franchise. They've moved past these allegations of the toxic workplace culture. It's almost like, okay, he's free and clear. We've taken a pretty light punishment, we meaning the NFL, and Snyder's going to survive this. And so the fact that that was used, that blackmail PowerPoint, that's the language that's used by people in the NFL league office. I think there is a through line from our story last October about Snyder saying, I've got private investigators that have dug up dirt. I don't know whether Snyder has it. It's just that he was telling people that, and there's certainly a through line from those allegations and the way his lawyers use these emails to try to get him as light a punishment as possible by Roger Goodell.
Yeah, I mean, it seems preposterous, not only in retrospect, but even at the time, it seemed preposterous that the subject of an investigation was allowed to dictate the terms of his own punishment and assist in the editing process of the press release as if it was a settlement of a dispute. And I think this all stems from the NFL's misguided decision to use Dan Snyder's own attorney, Beth Wilkinson, to co-opt or to take over that investigation and allow Dan Snyder to keep his foot wedged in the door with an ongoing and active role over this investigation and essentially tie the NFL's hands in undertaking a complete, unbiased, and transparent investigation. Why do you think the NFL took the easy way out and used Snyder's own attorney rather than what they're doing now, which is retaining people like Mary Jo White? And that's another story as to why that investigation is taking so long to wrap up. But I think this is all the fruit of the poisonous tree stemming back to the decision to involve Snyder at the outset by using his own attorney.
That's right. I think it all stems from that decision. And remember, there was an agreement that was struck, an extraordinary agreement was struck between Dan Snyder and the NFL that both sides were going to share all of the information that was developed by Beth Wilkinson during that investigation. That's not how true investigations are done. When prosecutors, as you guys know, or any investigator who's independent is investigating somebody, they don't agree to share this kind of information step by step. So it was a very cooperative stance that the NFL had with Snyder from the beginning, which can only lead one to conclude that it wasn't a real true investigation. It was a way to try to show that the public that we were investigating this, that we were doing our due diligence, because none of the findings of Wilkinson or a final report were ever released. Roger Goodell said that there was that they didn't want that because they were afraid of they wanted to try to protect the anonymity of the witnesses, including a lot of former cheerleaders. Of course, they were outraged by that because they thought there was going to be a report and there was no report. So every way you look at it, and now this is sort of a final chapter of this, of the punishment, and it raises, Dan, what you said, a kind of interesting question. I don't know the answer to it, of why Roger Goodell, every time he was presented with an opportunity to go hard or be tough on Snyder, took the lighter road, took a light punishment way. As we reported back in February, as you guys know, you had me on your podcast talking about the story that we broke about the limited partners who made all these allegations that Snyder had basically used the team as his personal piggy bank. And they wanted the limited partners, the three billionaire limited partners of Snyder, wanted the NFL arbitrator to aggressively investigate all of their allegations of financial wrongdoing by Snyder. That was shut down by Goodell in a matter of days when they were really pursuing that. So again, these are all questions for Roger Goodell. Why did you feel it so important to, at every turn, protect Snyder? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there's been some speculation around the league, including among some owners, that perhaps when Snyder was telling people that he did have dirt, that maybe he does actually have dirt on Roger Goodell. I want to be really clear. I have no reporting reflecting that, but there is speculation among some owners and team executives that maybe there is something to that. Or maybe it's simply that Roger Goodell is the shield. He often says that he wants to protect the shield, meaning the NFL shield, but he is really the shield for the 32 owners. And so even if somebody who's as toxic as Dan Snyder is, and even with most, if not all, the owners wanting him out, Goodell is still going to protect even somebody as toxic as Snyder to the final, you know, breath of his leadership as owner. And that's also been suggested to me as part of what motivated Goodell.
Yeah, but Don, what's to stop Dan Snyder from weaponizing these emails post-sale? Now that he's presumably on his way out, unless something crazy happens today, received $6.05 billion, has access to the information that he had before. Why should we think that Snyder's just going to recede into the background, go on his yacht and never be heard from again? You know, if we've learned anything about Snyder over the years, is that he could be engage in retribution and use, you know, leaks, and he could continue to play this game because now he's not beholden to an NFL ownership group that doesn't have any jurisdiction over him. So what would stop him from weaponizing these emails unless there's some agreement that you are aware of?
I'm not aware of an agreement, but you answered your own question, Dan. The only thing that could stop him is if there is an agreement, a secret agreement as part of the terms, and maybe it's part of some discussions about indemnification. We know that that's been an issue between Snyder and his lawyers and the NFL, the top NFL brass. I don't know, but we did report in our story that those 650,000 emails that were amassed by Beth Wilkinson, these are all, we should be really clear with your listeners, commanders' emails. So many of them are emails that were sent by Bruce Allen, the former team president, longtime president of the team. Basically, Bruce Allen told John Gruden that, in fact, there is so much bad stuff in there that touches almost everybody across the league. So this is this incredible toxic brew of bad information that could deeply embarrass the National Football League. And the only emails that have been made public are this handful of John Gruden emails. And that was a large reason why Seth Wickersham and I pursued this story that we published last week. Who had the motive to leak them and why? And that's, you know, what we really set out to try to show. And what we showed is there was a much larger group of executives that not only had access to the emails, but had motives to get them out into the public.
So here's where, you know, I guess this is this next chapter as we look ahead. There was this interesting, you know, I don't know if it's a news cycle for like 3-4 days, but that Snyder's indemnification issues could potentially hold up the sale. So you said something very interesting, Don. And I like how you lawyered Dan when you said you answered your own question. If a witness did that to Dan and I on the stand, that would not be a good day, but you know, it's a podcast, it's all good. So there's something here that's interesting, right? The emails, it's not just that they could be embarrassing to Washington. It's the tether that would tie litigation events to the Dan Snyder era. So my understanding, and not to keep shouting out ESPN, but the Jeremy Schapp had another good interview today with I think it's John. Is it Keim?
John Keim? Yeah, the longtime beat reporter. Yes. Of, I think going back to 1994, John's been covering the team.
Yeah, Dan and I have spoken about Steve Keim on the show, but John's first announcement on the show, first shout out. So John did an excellent job today. And then the question really was like, whether these indemnification issues, and people that don't know indemnification, maybe tune into our show more often. We talk about it a lot, but that these legal issues are not going to be on the dime of Josh Harris moving forward. That at least the understanding is that Dan Snyder will own these as we move ahead. Now, as far as I am aware, people say all these open lawsuits against the team. I'm not really aware of many open lawsuits. I'm aware of open investigations between the feds and the attorney general's office. I'm not, even those number of female employees that are represented by Lisa Banks, I'm not aware of any open lawsuits. Now, if you have 650,000 emails that are somewhere, and apparently someone at the NFL office was looking at these emails, because as you point out in your story, a lot of these emails were flagged. There's been a review of 650,000 emails, which, we don't have to pose a hypothetical, but those emails are probably very relevant to a number of either potential litigations or ones that are ongoing. Now, I bring that up with respect to this one very important topic, and this is where I think the rest of your story is, where the good reporting is. John Gruden, as we move forward, right? He's the one, and Dan, you made the joke, like the blackmail PowerPoint, like Snyder's trying to bring everybody down, but Snyder's now, on a yacht somewhere in Paris. John Gruden has the keys to a lawsuit where those 650,000 emails are very relevant. They're obviously discoverable. Dan Wallach on Twitter, I'll give you a shout. You mentioned that probably brought into this lawsuit as a result of your story, Dom. Probably, I would think, DeMarie Smith, Desiree Perez, and anybody else who is a potential leaker of these emails. But Don, what are you hearing in terms of, and I guess if you don't know this, you don't know it, but in terms of access and review and analysis of the 650,000 emails, I think all of those people, right? I think all of them probably get some sort of a subpoena, probably are asked to be deposed. Do you view that a number of people have access and viewed these emails, or is that circle very, very small? Because I'm curious where this goes moving forward.
Well, on the email question, one of the things we reported, I believe for the first time, is that there was a larger group that had access to these emails.
But someone had to flag them. That's where I'm getting my question. I don't know where it is.
Yeah. And we reported that, in fact, inside the NFL league office, there was actually a number of people that went and put in search terms and looked very carefully at those 650,000 emails and turned up some of these Gruden emails. Now, I believe from our reporting and from what I've been told that they were also flagged by the Dan Snyder law firm group, because again, it's a little bit complicated, and and let me try to explain it as best I can, as simply as I can. What the reporting shows, and I know I'm going away from your question a little bit, Dan, we'll get back to it, but I want to go to Dan Snyder.
There's no objections here to non-responsive. This is just okay. General comments. And I asked a compound question, so you could have objected to me there. So, it's all
right. No, but I want to take on this Dan Snyder and his legal folks' motive from what we were told, again, about why he would greenlight these Gruden emails to be leaked. And remember that what our reporting shows is that they got to the NFL, and the week that Roger Goodell was shown these emails, very early in that week, just in a matter of 72 hours, the Wall Street Journal is publishing the first leak, and then the New York Times is publishing one another 3 days, or another story with a number of emails, Gruden emails, just 3 days later, which cost him his job. But what we were told is what motivated Snyder is that he was frustrated in the middle of the season in 2021, because remember, he's coming off this slap in the wrist punishment where he believes by the midseason, he's going to be able to be back on the field before games. He's at every game at FedEx Field and on the road, but he's in the background. He's hiding. Okay. He's not seen. He wanted to go to league meetings. He was told by the league office and by Goodell, he could not do that. He was told that he needed to still stay away and be hidden. This was frustrating him, we were told. And he saw these Gruden emails as a way to ingratiate himself with Goodell because he knew there was animus and a bad relationship between Gruden and Goodell, which we lay out in the story. It's from Gruden's perspective, mind you, but we lay that on the story that dates back 10 years. And it was Snyder's way to try to get back in the good graces of Roger Goodell, because if Goodell green lights the leak, then he's got a win by basically taking out a racist head coach. And again, that's where allegedly Desiree Perez's and Roc Nation's role is also raised with us by multiple sources. So that's where that motive is coming from. And again, it's a little bit complicated because you think, okay, well, how did Demora Smith get involved? Well, it turns out Roger Goodell and Demora Smith had a conversation about that email, we were told, that week. And as you said earlier, we have a source very close to Demora Smith telling us that Smith bragged about being involved in that leak to the Wall Street Journal and that first email, that racist email that Gruden wrote. So I don't think I answered your question, Dan, but pose it again because I think that that motive is very important for listeners to understand sort of how this got going and why, in Snyder's view, it was going to try to help him. He also, by the way, saw Bruce Allen as somebody that he felt was responsible for the toxic workplace culture. Snyder had been fired by Allen had been fired by Snyder a couple of years earlier. And this was another motive, we were told, of why he wanted some of these emails to come out to try to rough up Bruce Allen.
Yeah, no, I guess just quickly, and I want to make, you know, want to be mindful of your time. And I find this, you know, obviously the devil's in the details, but this part the reason I've always said that Snyder has to enter this conversation as the leader in the clubhouse is not because there was a leak of Washington emails. That could have been done by attorneys. It could have been done by a hacker. It doesn't really say that. But of the 650,000 emails, the ones that came out, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was they were John Gruden to Bruce Allen. That was it. It wasn't, you know, and this is, we're not going to, there's a, I don't know how closely you follow news. There's a law firm under investigation now that I won't mention them because we know people that work there, but there are emails that were released to the public between two partners that left the firm, really bad emails between partner A and partner B. Now, if partner A and partner B have bad emails between each other, racist, misogynistic, homophobic, it's a good bet that partner A also has bad emails with partner C, D, E, and F, and same with B between C, D, E, and F. But the only emails that were released, as far as I know, in this John Gruden saga, were Bruce Allen to John Gruden. So that tells me, logically, whoever was part of the filter of these email release probably had an axe to grind with both John Gruden and or Bruce Allen, or else that nexus obviously would have gone a little bit further. So, and if Bruce Allen sending bad email or John Gruden sending bad emails to Bruce Allen, probably sending bad emails to other people in the organization. So my question was who had access to the information, but what I was trying to really get at is, you know, what can we tell from the leak of information as to kind of clues as to who did it? And I do think that there are, and this is my opinion, some Snyder fingerprints that you could easily glean from who else was on these emails. And John Gruden's certainly going to get to the bottom of that. But I find I'm very interested in this little piece here, which I imagine Gruden's attorneys are as well.
Right. They are. And, the Gruden attorneys are hopeful that they're going to get the opportunity to do the discovery and potentially get a hold of these 650,000 emails. I mean, you're right that the motives here are either somebody with animus toward John Gruden, somebody with animus toward Bruce Allen, or both. In the case of Demora Smith, it's potentially no animus. It's just an opportunity timed to the fact that the 32 player reps were about to vote for a contract extension at a time when he was an embattled leader of the NFLPA and his job was on the line. And as I said, he won that vote by a single vote. That's what we tried to do. Now, we can talk about the Gruden lawsuit in Nevada because sure you guys want to discuss that. Let's focus on that because it is a monster for the NFL and it has not been going well for the NFL. So John Gruden filed a lawsuit a month after he lost his job. This is in November of 2021 against the National Football League and against Roger Goodell personally, alleging that they were responsible for the leaks that cost him his job and his career. And the district court judge ruled in favor of Gruden. The NFL tried to get the case moved to arbitration. And as you guys know, that's the venue of choice for the National Football League because it's behind closed doors. They have friendly lawyers that make these decisions. We saw the same thing happen with the arbitration between Snyder and his three limited partners that I wrote about last February. The arbitrator there was a guy named Brad Karp, who's a lawyer for the NFL from a white shoe law firm. And so that's what the NFL is trying to do here with the Gruden lawsuit. They want to move it to arbitration. The district court judge said no. And then the NFL appealed. The appellate court in Nevada also sided with Gruden. So now it's before the Nevada Supreme Court. We expect a decision late this year. But if the Nevada Supreme Court sides with Gruden, that means, as you guys know, there will be discovery. There will be subpoenas. Yep. And you know who they subpoena, Dan, I don't know. But certainly Roger Goodell is going to be near the top, if not the top of that list. They're certainly going to try to get, I believe, all 650,000 emails because they're germane, because they claim, the Gruden lawyers claim in their court papers, that they were cherry picked against Gruden because of, you know, what they allege to be this bad blood on the part of Goodell. And the language in our story is very colorful. You know, Gruden has told associates of his that Goodell ordered a kill shot to his career, that he took him out. And we know from people around Gruden that he is hellbent on going all the way and not settling. And the language that was used is he's willing to burn the house down to get to the truth of what happened. So that's where we are. And, you know, as you guys can imagine, this is potentially a very expensive very damaging lawsuit facing the National Football League right now.
Yeah, but it's not going completely against the NFL so far. They lost before the district court in Nevada, but the Nevada Supreme Court issued an order granting the NFL's motion to stay the litigation.
They did.
And the outcome of this appeal before the Nevada Supreme Court, which while it's been fully briefed, it hasn't even been set for oral argument yet. And who knows how many months after that oral argument, a decision will be rendered. It seems to be going, you know, very slowly. And it's a tactic that the NFL has employed successfully in the Brian Flores case, even just asserting an arbitration provision, just stalls the litigation on the merits by like up to 2 years while the NFL and the party suing it are battling over whether this arbitration clause is enforceable. And so far, it's a year and a half into Gruden, a year and a half into Brian Flores. There hasn't been a shred of discovery propounded in either case because of the NFL's arbitration provision, which while it hasn't been completely successfully invoked, just the mere existence of that clause has led to these preliminary skirmishes that have denied the plaintiffs their access to evidence. So, which raises the issue of ultimate accountability here. Are we really relying on a civil lawsuit to sort of settle all accounts here when the NFL, when it was faced with almost certain multi-billion-dollar liability in the St. Louis state court system, was able to throw enough money at the problem to make it go away? Will there ever be accountability here? I know you mentioned in your article that many people have paid a price, but as I see it, Dan Snyder has walked away with $6 billion. Roger Goodell still survives to this day as the NFL commissioner, despite weaponizing or allegedly weaponizing these emails. DeMaurice Smith is walked away and is retired as the executive director of the National Football League Players Association. And, you know, Ms. Perez has faced no accountability for her alleged transgressions while Gruden's career has been ruined. And there are a number of, you know, victims in the Commanders and Redskins organization that have not seen their pound of flesh or their justice administered. Does it all basically rise and fall on what takes place in Nevada, or could there be other venues where justice could be meted out?
I don't know the answer to that. That's Dan. That's such a terrific question. I do know that the one threat, and it's almost an existential threat in the same way that the lawsuit involving the fleeing of St. Louis by the Rams to Los Angeles was, is that it potentially may be a massive payday for Gruden. Now, again, I said earlier on this podcast that Gruden has said, I'm not going to settle. I only want the truth. I want the truth to come out. I mean, you know, that's a potentially very dangerous plaintiff to the NFL if there is no check large enough to buy him off and make him go away, right? But as we know, there may be enough money and they may have to throw that amount of money at him. You're right, by the way, to say that this is still a tough road. I don't want listeners to come away thinking that the Nevada Supreme Court is leaning one way or the other. There's been no oral argument. The fact that they stayed it, you're right. The arbitration provision has carried the day in other courts. The NFL knows that, so they still have a pretty good hand. It's just the fact that both at the district court level and at the appellate court level in Nevada, surprisingly, Gruden has won. So he's 2-for-2. Yep. And we'll see what happened. But as far as any other venues, I don't know if there'll be, you know, any justice or pound of flesh, to use your language, on this. And let's look at Snyder, though. Snyder is walking away. It's actually not $6 billion. He owes $1 billion to Bank of America. So it's $5 billion, but that's still five $1 billion Powerball jackpots that was just awarded this week. That's a ton of money that he is getting for being arguably the worst NFL owner in the league's history. And but this is a team that he loved since he was a boy. It was his entire identity. I think I've talked with you guys about this on a previous podcast. This hurts him. It hurts him. His reputation is shot based on the allegations and the investigations and the scandals. If in 2 or 3 years, the Josh Harris-led Washington Commanders wins a Super Bowl, that's going to hurt Dan Snyder badly. Because when he became the owner of the Commanders in 1999, Paul Tagliabue said he's the perfect person to own this team. At the time, Snyder was a 34-year-old young man who said that he was going to turn the team into a winner. They won one playoff game in 2005. And, you know, and this is the worst franchise now, the lowest in attendance, lowest in local revenue. He's cost his fellow owners a ton of money. And he walks away, yes, with a lot of money, but with no reputation left after, you know, this dream. He said it was a dream of his to own this team. And it's ended for him as a nightmare, because he's no longer going to be able to say he's the owner of the team he's loved since he was a kid.
Yeah, Don, yeah. I have one recommendation for you. I mean, I still feel that there are more Dan Snyder stories that are going to be in the pipeline. I wouldn't necessarily say that this is the final chapter, but eventually I would recommend that you turn your attention to James Dolan up in New York City. I think he might be an adequate replacement for Dan Snyder. You'd be doing all of us. You'd be doing the city of New York and the fan bases of two major professional teams a mitzvah if you could turn your attention to the National Hockey, to the NBA and NHL just slightly.
Not a bad idea, Dan. I'm a Knicks fan. Look, I grew up in northern New Jersey. I'm a Knicks and Mets fan since I was a kid, and I know all about James Dolan. It's not a bad idea. And look, on Snyder, there may be more. The books are not closed. There could be civil litigation from the cheerleaders. Lisa Banks could be filing something. We know that there's a federal criminal investigation going on in the Eastern District of Virginia, as we first reported. That investigation, as I understand it, is ongoing on those financial impropriety allegations. So, yeah, there's still plenty of shoes that could drop.
Don't sleep on the Carl Racine case. The D.C. Attorney General has, he's no longer the Attorney General, but that's a consumer fraud and unfair trade practices lawsuit. That's not something that, you know, the district may want to settle so easily. They want the Wilkinson report released. They want discovery here. And that could be something that ends up burning the NFL and Dan Snyder. But like many other cases, this one is also mired in delays because there's a jurisdictional battle over whether this case belongs in federal court or in the D.C. Superior Court. And the motion to throw it back to Superior Court has been pending for 5 months. So it really is a matter of randomness as to which one activates first. But all these various points of entry and risks for the NFL in various court cases, they're all on a very slow road to a conclusion. And they're not going so quickly where we're going to have any expectation of gaining access to this evidence anytime soon.
That's right. The slow walking of all of these investigations and lawsuits is a central page in the NFL playbook. It's worked before. It's working now. It will work in the future. And don't forget about Mary Jo White. When you talked about, you know, talk about a slow walk, we're now in month 17 of Mary Jo White's investigation, which was triggered, as our story pointed out, in large part by these leaks. You know, one of the things that we reported is we had a congressional source tell us that Congress, that committee, opened up that investigation of Dan Snyder, the Washington Commanders, and of the National Football League, basically because of these leaked emails. And we had sources say, close to Snyder, he was free and clear if there had not been these Gruden email leaks. So in large part, he did this to himself, because as you guys remember, in February of 2022, Tiffany Johnston made an allegation that Snyder was guilty of sexual misconduct directly with her. That's what triggered the Mary Jo White investigation. And I wouldn't be surprised if that drops tomorrow, Friday, July 21st, one day after they close the books on Dan Snyder. There'll be this, you know, so much glee in Washington because there's new ownership and Snyder's finally gone. And then going into a weekend, we'll finally get the Mary Jo White findings.
See, it's funny you say that, Dan and I, that's the last thing on my list. And I guess, you know, we can start to wrap, but you know, the Mary Jo White report, 3-4 months ago, there was some, rumblings on Twitter that it was in its final stages. And 3-4 months ago was already at the year marker. So we made a bold proclamation, and we're happy to be right. I said, there is no way the Mary Jo White report comes out before the sale is finalized. It's just not going to happen. And, you know, as we sit here today, we're recording this again on Thursday, July 20th. It's not out. So I think that was probably part of Josh Harris's design. The other thing that we should say as attorneys, you know, sometimes we'll have a litigation event or an investigation or something that'll take a year and a half, a year, 2 years, 3 years. There is not a world where we do not provide a periodic and a regular update, be it at a 90-day increment, a 60-day increment. So whatever Mary Jo White is finding, she has an obligation generally, I don't know what her retainer agreement is, but to provide regular updates to the person or the entity that's paying her, and that's the NFL. So they must have some indication of what's going on. I'm not a betting man, but that's not really true. I am somewhat of a betting man. We're not going to find odds in this somewhere. But at the end of the day, we had so much anger from our listeners and people on social media about the lack of a written report from Beth Wilkinson. Didn't exist, right? Everyone, it was just your reporting. I messaged you on this. I thought this was a great find. The retainer called for a written report, and then we didn't ultimately get one. The Mary Jo White report, you can bet the house on it, right? If you can find some fictitious odds somewhere on this, that there will be a written report on Mary Jo White. And we'll see if it opens up Pandora's box. We'll see about these litigation events that follow. But that's where this indemnification language comes in, because we have not really seen these waves of lawsuits that we were expecting. Dan, despite, you know, the Carl Racine lawsuit and the congressional investigation, we haven't seen that many lawsuits, but statute of limitations, you know, those things run for a while.
They do. And I agree with you. I think we will see a report by Mary Jo White. I know that has been the pledge and the promise that Mary Jo White and her attorneys have made to the witnesses that she has interviewed and her team have interviewed. Lisa Banks has been on the record saying that's the expectation. It was their expectation, of course, that Beth Wilkinson was also going to file a final report that would make all of Beth Wilkinson's findings public. And of course, that did not happen. But I agree. I think it would be such a bad look for the National Football League if they were to, again, do a summary of findings and not release Mary Jo White's report. I think there's more motive for them to do it because Snyder will be gone. And I agree with you guys. I know there was a lot of speculation a few months ago in various places in the media. And we were hearing it too. Wickersham and I were picking up on this too, that she was nearing the end of her work. But there was nothing in it for the National Football League to release this until Snyder is gone. And they're hoping it'll be a one-day story and that all of the focus will be on Josh Harris and, you know, potentially the longest honeymoon in Washington, D.C. history. There's going to be a lot of goodwill in Washington for Josh Harris. And all he has to do is be the anti-Dan Snyder. And just do basically, you know, that old thing, you know, what would Elmore Leonard do? You know, the great crime novelist. There's people that have done shows that have also asked that. Josh Harris is going to say, what would Dan Snyder do? And I'm going to do the opposite. And there's going to be a lot of goodwill, and he's going to have a very long runway to turn things around, get a new stadium, you know, from a fan base that's absolutely Sick of Snyder, doesn't want to hear his name again, nor does anyone else in the National Football League among the owners want to hear his name again either. They're ready to turn the page as well.
I think that's a good place to end this. So we're gonna keep watch. I imagine, again, by the time that this podcast comes out, the Josh Harris era will officially be commenced. Maybe to your, I like this bold prediction. Maybe the Mary Jo White report is out with it. That would be pretty poetic justice. But Don, excellent job. And I, as much as this Dan Snyder chapter is ending, the Dan Snyder chapter in general is not being done written. So certainly expect to see more from you guys and continue to lead the charge at ESPN. You're one of our favorites. So thanks for coming on. And now we know why we like you. We're all New Yorkers here. That's what it is. That's what it is.
That's what we have in common.
Or New Jerseyans, Northeasterns. Maybe that's it.
That's right. Yeah. No, I'm the North Jersey kid. And listen, guys, it's always a pleasure to be with both of you. Your questions are great. You've done a great job on this story. And it's always a pleasure. And I appreciate all your kind words as well.
Will we ever see a Knicks NBA championship in this century?
No. Oh.
If it happens in this century, Dan, you and I are not going to be around to see it if it's the end of the century. So the question is whether we're going to see it in our lifetimes. And I sure hope so. We're overdue for sure. And we're on the right path. I think we are actually have turned the corner with the leadership of the team. We've got some good pieces together. So
I'm a pessimist. I'm sort of long suffering person. I point to the botching of the Obi Toppin draft pick, which is just they sold him 10 cents on the dollar, and they haven't had number one picks in either of the last 2 years. So aside from getting lucky with the tampering of Jalen Brunson, I don't look at this, at this management team as having been maybe marginally effective, but having a 4-year run of draft picks and having what do they have to show for it? Quentin Grimes. In 4 years of having number one draft picks, that's all they come away with?
I agree. The draft grades are terrible. I'm grading them on the curve of the prior administrations, including Phil Jackson. So bad, right? And look, we've got Brunson. We that's a key piece. And, look, I'm as pessimistic as you are. I'm trying to be sort of cautiously optimistic, at least, about the team's chances. I mean, I saw glimmers of hope, which I had not seen in so long last year, and a couple times at Madison Square Garden in person. And so I'm hoping that we'll get there.
Yeah, I go back to Willis Reed, Earl Monroe, Walt Frazier. My first year of being a sports fan was the year after they won their first NBA championship. And that was my first team. So they're like so close to my heart. And I remember the glory days, of that title team, which had a very short run. And then, over the last 50 years, has been trying to chase glory unsuccessfully with a bunch of short-sighted moves and bad drafting.
Well, losing in game 7 to the Rockets in 1994 when John Starks went 3-for-18 from 3-point land, I can't get over that game.
Oh, so we should do a podcast on that one next on the Knicks next time. But yeah, it is somewhat frustrating. They have improved, but anyway, we'll let you go, but we will we'll be sure to, you and I, talk a little bit Knicks basketball, whether it's on a future podcast or whenever we have a chance to meet in Miami.
I would love that, Dan. I look forward to it. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for spending so much time with us and sharing your insights on the Dan Snyder saga.
All good. Thank you, Don. Appreciate your time.
Thanks again, guys.
That was Don Van Natta at ESPN. Don is one of the best. And I'll say this. Hopefully Don listens to the outro. Anytime there's these big, we'll say departures from ESPN, I look at names and I always see, sad to see names go, people that I've grown up with watching. Don is just a pillar at ESPN. And these reports, these investigative reports, make Don one of the best in the entire business. So I'm happy to see he's sticking at ESPN. And I'm happy to see Dan, and we were talking about Don kind of offline. I'm happy to see that ESPN is investing in giving him the leash to write these stories. They're so important. And as we've seen, really good journalism, just like we saw with Northwestern, and now we're seeing with ESPN and Don and Seth, they really move the needle on these stories.
Well, long form journalism is still in vogue. I mean, with the New York Times having basically outsourced its sports department to The Athletic, they are still going to, keep doing these long form, larger sort of, 30,000 square foot view stories. So I can't envision ESPN being ESPN without Don's style of investigative journalism. I mean, it's really the bastion of the whole industry. If you're thinking about sports investigative journalism, you know, Don, Seth, I mean, they are the pillars, not just of the network, but the entire, you know, journalism space surrounding sports investigative journalism. Their stories, not only are must reads on the day they come out, they have this sort of perpetual life to them and momentum that lasts for, you know, weeks and months. And when a DVN Junior story comes out, it's big.
Yeah, Dan, I agree with you, Don. It's so funny. And you know, we referenced it a little bit on, a little bit off. But like, you know, I don't think, you know, you really need a podcast. You really need the long form to get into the nuance of the story and to talk mm-hmm. about the parts that Don finds to be important. People can go back in our archives and listen to the Washington stuff. But, you know, what we really wanted to tap is the new stuff that were in the article and the really kind of finer legal points. So we'll release this to everybody. You know, but, you know, certainly it's good to have Don on. And as we said, this is the close of the Dan Snyder owning the Washington Commanders chapter, but it can't be the end of the Snyder chapter without the Mary Jo White report. So
even with that, that won't be the end of it. Dan Snyder will, you know, should be somewhat relevant on all these other pending open matters, the Gruden case, the D.C. Attorney General case, the potential criminal investigation or ongoing criminal investigation in the Eastern District of Virginia. So I don't think we've heard the last, by far, we haven't heard the last of Dan Snyder and legal exposure, because I think that's that issue, or those issues continue on a number of multiple different fronts. His tenure as NFL owner is about to end, but that doesn't mean the judicial system is ready to say goodbye to him just yet.
Yeah, Dan. So I guess, we'll figure out a label. It's the end of one Dan Snyder chapter, but, big shout out to Don for joining us. You can find just Google Don. You'll find Don everywhere. He's done tons of articles. One of the longest tenured and most, senior and one of the best people at ESPN. Yep. So we love having Don on. A quick reminder, a little bit of business podcast sponsored by Themis Bar Review, top bar prep company in the entire galaxy. This is the time. Of bar prep. People get anxious, and hopefully you're using Themis. And if you're a 2L, you're a 1L, you're about a year away from bar prep, think about Themis.
The future is now. Don't wait until the summer of your bar exam to start thinking Themis. Take advantage of the opportunities early, and you know, they're the best. So never a bad idea to lock up your bar prep well before you finish your third year of law school.
A surprise ad read from Dan. Dan, I like it. I like it. A little bit of a programming note. Dan and I, you know, we'd like to get back to Dan and I recording more regularly. Dan, what are we thinking? In the next month, 2 months, we'll be back to semi-regular, you and I?
Yeah, I think at some point next week, the transition will be, I wouldn't say the transition is complete, but I've devoted the last couple of months to, you know, sort of, you know, being available almost around the clock. I have a newborn son, and it's really taken away from some of my podcasting. It's also inhibited some of my work, but priorities are priorities. But I think in another week or two, once we're settled and we're back home, I'll be in a regular rotation to continue the podcast with you, if not every week, certainly fairly regularly. So I'm looking forward to getting back into the saddle. It's been a long period where I've just been on, you know, sort of, you know, part-time status, but I'm ready to dig in again, beginning in late July, early August, or I guess starting now with this episode.
I guess we're all excited here, Dan. So all good. That'll put this episode in the books.
One's going to lose a job. No one's going to lose their job because I'm coming back.
No one's going to lose their job. Just more content, which is good. So we'll put this in the books. As always, you can find us at conductdetrimental.com, our socials in the show notes. Thanks to Don. Thanks to everybody for putting this together. And yeah, we'll see you next time on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.